everybody. You're listening to You, Me, Them, Everybody. My name is Brandon Weatherby, and sitting across from me is one of the smartest people I could ever have met, and I know him, and I can't pronounce his last name, so I'm just going to say his first, and that first name is Mitchell.
Szczepańczyk.
Please say that again.
Szczepańczyk.
And how many Scrabble points is that?
52.
That's crazy.
In English.
That's crazy.
In Polish, it's only 17 points.
So there's a different score by language?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. In Polish, Z's, unaccented Z's are only worth 1 point each.
How many blocks in the Polish version do you
get? I think it's 100, but because the distribution of letters in Polish is different than that in English, mm-hmm. the point values differ, and also different letters. Like, there are three different types of Z's in Polish.
And you know all about this because?
I'm word nerd. I'm Polish.
Well, you're Polish and you're a very smart guy.
Thank you.
If you're from Chicago, the way you might know Mitchell is because he was the cover story in The Reader. And was that around, New
March
Year's?
March 20th was
March
the day.
March 20th?
Day,
so not even
dropped.
That long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the cover story was about the digital transition. And Mitchell was the guy kind of leading the fight about why this was not the best idea. Is this correct?
I was
not
one
the
of the,
guy, but one of the
like
main
one
guys.
Of the major players and probably one of the leading voices that wasn't affiliated with one of the industries that was poised to cash in big on the transition.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was that I had been working on it for, oddly enough, for about 4 years before the transition happened.
Working on what?
As in political activism that I've done on media issues, a lot of the work I tend to do tends to be of the focus of serving as a kind of informational resource and also spreading the word about things.
Okay.
So that's what I did, basically, to try to learn as much I could about the situation from a critical perspective, not having to worry about whether or not my bosses are going to make as much money as possible on the basis of my work.
So you're the outside independent guy.
Yeah.
What initially... So you knew about the transition 4 years before it was going to happen, or you were just guessing that this might happen?
No. I've been part of the political... Kind of maybe jumping ahead here.
No, don't worry. We can
political,
go on any...
Political activism in media issues, there's a community of people who've been working on this stuff, and I'm lucky enough to be a part of it. And there had been hints here and there of a digital television transition that was poised to happen... Throughout 2002, 2003, it finally crystallized in 2005
mm-hmm.
when Congress actually passed the law and the president signed the law that actually said February 17, 2009, all high-powered analog television in the United States ceases and any subsequent broadcasting must happen digitally.
Okay, and why did that happen? What's the purpose of this?
There's one stated reason, which is true, but one seamier side to the story
okay.
that's less well known.
Let's
but
go
which
with the main
wrong.
One that everyone
okay.
knows. And then
the big story, which is nonetheless true, is that it's far more efficient to handle broadcasting digitally than via analog. You
okay.
need less spectrum, more channels can be used, the quality of picture and sound can be improved, and that freed up spectrum can be used for other uses. Nominally, people say that could be freed up for emergency communications, like firefighters and
mm-hmm.
Police and for ambulances, things like that.
Okay.
And these are all true, and these are all valid reasons. The fact of the matter, though, is that there's the senior side, which has to do with the fact that a lot of people are going to be making a lot of money off of the transition as it's been happening. The broadcasters themselves, mostly in the commercial bandwidth, have basically are getting back the equivalent of 5 to 7 times the value of spectrum that they're giving up for digital spectrum they're getting back in return.
Okay, so it's for a layman like me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just to translate that into English, it means that the amount of money and the potential commercial time stands to be at least 5 to 7 times that of what could be had by keeping things as is.
Okay.
And so that was the motivation. That was one motivation. But it's also that That freed up spectrum can also be used as actually has already been planned by what had been channels 53 through 69 on the UHF band could be sold off to cell phone companies so that that spectrum could be used for cell phone communications. And there was one particularly noxious auction that took place around February and March 2008 that the FCC had organized, where just two companies, AT&T and Verizon, wound up buying up about 80% of the available spectrum, ponying up close to $20 billion, just two companies.
So this is $20 billion that went to what was currently being used for channels 53 to 68, which are now no longer being used for that purpose.
Correct.
And now those are owned by Verizon and AT&T.
For the most part, those two companies. A lot of spectrum was auctioned off, and a number of other companies did wind up buying them up, and there were maybe eight or so companies, large and small, that wound up getting the lion's share of the rest.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is that it's handled as a kind of auction, and it's not done without any public involvement. I mean, there's a humongous windfall here regarding how this could be used to help people with the creation of new channels, with the freeing up of spectrum for digital innovative uses. There's tremendous potential here, and it's not being utilized precisely because major moneyed interests don't want to use it that way.
Okay, so now the other channels, the other UHF signals, mm-hmm. I'm probably butchering this and I apologize.
That's okay.
Everything between 0 or 1 and 52, what's going on with those?
And now that has, for the most part, basically, the what's slated to happen with that is that's going to, portions of that will be reallotted to newfound digital television signals. Portion, so that means that, I don't know, pick a channel in Chicago.
Seven. Channel ABC 7.
Okay, ABC 7. So ABC 7 is going to, what had been the analog portion of the spectrum that broadcast mm-hmm. 7, is going, only a smaller portion of that will be allotted for not only just Channel 7, but sister channels related to Channel 7, because that signal can be chopped down into more finely refined portions that can also be broadcast.
Isn't that a good thing?
In one sense, yes.
Okay.
But in some sense, it's like also quite asking how's that going to be used, and how are people going to be benefiting? When major broadcasters were actually asked by the FCC in Washington, so you're getting this whole new windfall of a lot of these major channels. You could probably get anywhere from 6, perhaps at some point down the road, 20 channels that you're getting basically for the receiving of a single broadcast license that you now have. Mm-hmm. What are you planning to do with that? And the response was to quote at the time acting FCC chair Michael Copps, they looked at their feet. Those were his words. Meaning they had no plan. They were basically just going to squat on this main humongous windfall, maybe make 2 or 3 channels and sit on the rest until such time as maybe they may be able to someday make money off of it or not. But that's tremendous channel bandwidth that could be used for who knows what. There's tremendous potential here and tremendous imagination that could be brought to bear here. Mm-hmm. And it's just not. And not only is that a shame, but it's also the fact that if people knew about this windfall, and that's been a lot of the role I've played in my political activism on this stuff, that people would be justifiably angry and want to get involved. And that's actually been the secret of success in politics on media that I've been lucky to be a part of over the last 6+ years, by basically spreading the word about this stuff.
Well, in something like this, how could people get involved other than also spreading the word?
Well, a number of things I always suggest. One is obviously to spread the word, because that has actually been the key component to wins that we've had on a number of media-related issues in the last few years. So that, if I had to pick one thing, that's first and foremost. Tell people. Spread the word. Share information. Share. I mean, just by listening to this broadcast, a lot of people are getting a lot more information would rank them probably in the upper maybe 5% of people who know anything about this stuff. So that's one thing. Don't hoard this information. I certainly don't. Spread it as widely as possible. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your enemies. Everything you can do to help to share the word, and especially these days with a lot of social networking website resources, mm-hmm. that's not inconsiderable. So that's one thing. Second thing is to contact various civic authorities and elected officials. Very often, a lot of the involvement that people that the elected officials ever hear on this stuff is mainly from the interests who are going to make a lot of money out of this, mm-hmm. and they don't exactly see where a lot of people they just think don't care, but if people do care, and a lot of people do care, especially where information is brought to bear, it's like, I didn't know this. Why didn't anyone tell me this? Then not only do people find out about it, they, in fact, this has actually been correlated in public opinion surveys. The more people know about it, the more they tend to get outraged over how things were set up in their name but without their informed consent. And then they get angry and want to do something about it. The one thing I would suggest, like a second thing besides informing people, is to tell people to speak up to your elected representatives on this stuff. And the third thing I would actually suggest would be to what would be the third thing? It was like I usually have three talking points, and it might be the headache that I have. I can't remember all.
So okay.
We'll leave it at two for the moment.
Okay, but in a situation like this, where the transition has already occurred. Mm-hmm. What could they do? Because everyone already knows that everyone that has a television knows that this happened.
Right.
And in theory, there's no way to go backwards.
True, but that doesn't mean that the fight is over by any long shot. In fact, on the contrary, it may be just beginning. Remember that a lot of the moving of where this transition and the impacts of that are still very much in flux, and probably will be, who knows, maybe the next few years, could be as long as 10 years. We don't know. We're right now in what... Bob McChesney, in his excellent book Communications Revolution, called a critical juncture. It's a relatively brief time in American history where involvement on this, in things like speaking up, in contacting your elected officials, in spreading the word on this stuff, can make a difference, and especially a critical one, more so than other times in American history. And we're in that period now where we're in that flux, and not just in television, but throughout our entire media. We're lucky that we have this rare confluence of circumstances that have accorded us this chance to change the rules of the game, and hopefully in a positive manner. How that might materialize is a matter that is staggeringly complex, or potentially so. But what is resoundingly simple is that the more people get involved with it, the better the output winds up becoming for the public. And,
okay.
And that's been the thing I've been advocating for ever.
So in an ideal situation, what would everyone do, or what would you do to make the... okay.
So suppose I'm king of the world.
You're king of the world. You're king of the world, and you're a fair king. What do you do next?
I would encourage... What I would do is I would have the broadcast... There are a number of things that can be done here. One would be... and it depends on the media. Focus on television.
Yeah.
In that case, I would have the this windfall of extra channels allotted to stations, not just national but regional and local stations.
Mm-hmm.
And open up the kind of like maybe like a, I wouldn't call it the competitive bidding process, but something like maybe like the FCC opens up windows for possible station owners from time to time, usually radio, but television.
Yeah, but in radio, that's always backfired.
That's true, but that's a long-sorted story about that. But nonetheless, having something, and especially where the rules of that have not exactly helped people, and that's actually changed in recent years.
Yeah.
That's another podcast someday, though. But just to go back to this, opening up that matter to local stations, and also placing limits not only on who can apply, but how many of stations any single entity can apply for. This has been another major issue I've worked on, the matter of concentration of media ownership mm-hmm. in the United States. And that's another podcast that we can talk about someday. But the fact that there should be, and in fact, in recent windows that the FCC's opened, there have been limits, very strict ones, in fact, that have made a big difference on this front. So to open that up to that regard, make available resources, so that would mean an infusion that would probably make the stimulus package that we've seen in recent years look like peanuts, of serious amounts of money to the development not only of that channel, but also the infrastructure to make that happen. Stations, equipment, now computer technology, and training, so that people, and also the kind of like major public literacy on media involvement campaign. So then feed in a lot of money on that. And it seems like, oh, that's pie in the sky. The amount of money that we allot every year in the value of this spectrum is and has always gone up even faster than the rate of inflation. There's a lot of money that can be allotted to this.
Where does that money go then? Where is it being spent now?
Overwhelmingly, it's going into the coffers of the major media, in this case, broadcasters, but a lot of the major media industries. This is, and just to mention one small example, a single radio station with a high power frequency in Chicago can, if it, the license for that, if it's sold, can fetch upwards at least $180 million. That's serious money.
How often are those signals sold?
Fairly rarely, because precisely because they are tremendous cash cows.
Okay.
And as a result, that means that you can't. People will tend to hang on to them, unless you happen to be a humongous venture capitalist and have a lot of money to try to buy up them, and the law allows you to do so. Until recently, that has been the case. Now we're actually seeing a little bit of a deconcentration in our major media, but it's still pretty serious, and matters to be taken of that have to be taken. But that's basically what I would advocate: the establishment of new media using this windfall more widely than we've ever seen. A lot of people, I mean, we've seen the popularity of something like YouTube just take off.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine not only something like that, but where people can not only just take something like public access television, but have that writ large, not just on cable television, but across society, in all kinds of channels and all kinds of fora, and with all kinds of topics at play. I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine who got his PhD in mathematics from the University of Chicago.
Okay.
And I made the pitch to him, maybe someday someone could make a math cable broadcast channel,
mm-hmm.
not just cable channel. You see all kinds of niche channels all the time.
Of course.
So, but I mean, that's something, but have that just for math and in broadcast and in various fora, large and small, across the United States. Now, this is far easier said than done. And having been a part of a regular TV series myself, I know.
And that was that was on CAN, right?
CAN TV and Free Speech TV. Chicago Independent Television is the name of the show.
Okay.
That is a half hour a month show. And it's a lot just to even put that together. It seems like, we can just put things up. And like, no, if you were involved with this, it takes a lot of work, especially if you want to get it to the standards where people would have it be, give it expectations of quality of any kind.
Yeah.
And that requires a lot of work, but there's also tremendous rewards. And so being able to provide the resources where people have that freedom and ability to be able to do that work, I would allot that in that way. And broadcasters would probably scream bloody murder, but they've been given this tremendous windfall, and they've made promises saying that they would be able to materially raise the cultural level of the nation, to borrow the words of David Sarnoff, who was a longtime head of NBC, or like chairman of the board. He was also involved with RCA as well. But he basically touted television even long before its widespread distribution in society, that it was going to be the big game changer and it would improve everyone else and you'd see all this quality programming. And he should know and also played a role as far as this trajectory, because he was the head of one of the major broadcast outlets in America on this front. And he wound up dropping the ball.
I know this is a very this isn't a question that anyone can answer,
mm.
but as someone that studies this stuff, is TV even that powerful anymore?
Now, that's a serious question about its power and also perhaps its longer-term prospects.
Okay.
Now, there's been talk, and this has just materialized just within calendar year 2009, that a lot of the major broadcast channels have floated the idea, whether or not they're going to actually do this is another question, but they floated the idea that they would want to stop broadcasting. CBS and NBC, for example, would in effect become just two more cable channels, and they would, because mainly, at least in the immediate reason, having to do with the recent serious recession that we're in. Some might call it a depression, maybe we're very close to it. But the economy is crap, and that's had a humongous effect on broadcasters, because their sole source of income has been through advertising of airtime. But a lot of their major advertisers have, well, in the case of the auto industry, gone into bankruptcy, and yeah, they're not spending any money. In the case of the banking industry, same thing there. A lot of them are going bankrupt or getting humongous bailouts and have to tighten their belts unless they're paying multi-million-dollar bonuses to executives. But the fact is, they're not spending money on advertising, or far a fraction of what they once had. That, as well as the general economic downturn, have totaled to maybe about a 20 to 40% decrease in the last 6 months or so of revenue for broadcasting. And broadcast outlets are basically asking the question, is it even worth it to do this anymore? And there some people are floating the idea, maybe not. Now, whether or not this will actually happen is another thing to consider, and who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, remember, this was, if you asked me this question a year ago and I would have floated this idea, you would have thought I would be crazy, and everyone would.
But the fact is,
it's now it's gone from utterly crazy to thinkable, and possibly even almost realistic.
Well, okay, do you know anything about Hulu or sites like that?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so a site like Hulu, a website like Netflix, and a YouTube, you don't need a television anymore.
And that's a big fear that people have, and that's one thing. Thing, though, is some things to consider. One is that the internet is not a universal medium. Not everyone has internet.
Not yet.
So hopefully the penetration will achieve 100% of the population. We've actually grown a little bit. The rate of growth has actually declined somewhat. There might be some leveling off. The jury's still out on that. But that one thing is that television's not a universal internet is not a universal medium. Second thing is that the broadband, the capacity of the internet to be able to carry video at any level, never mind YouTube, but perhaps a full size screen stream that you would get on a giant size plasma screen. We're pretty far from that as far as delivering that as far as across the entire population.
Yeah.
And that's a major, and that I think is going to be the next bone of contention to make sure that we've got the bandwidth to be able to carry all this video. And that's a real, that's a fight that's galvanizing now. And where that's going to go, anyone is anyone's guess. But I will say that the odds improve the more people get involved in every capacity they can. And we've seen this time and again regarding all the media fights I've been lucky enough to be a part of going back to 2002.
Let's get off of this just for a
sure.
while. Because we can go on for literally hours.
Oh, but yeah.
How did you get involved in all this stuff? I mean, people, it's not necessarily the easiest thing to get involved with. I mean,
yeah. So how did I get involved in this political stuff? I'll mention two key events in my political education, we'll call it. One happened to be a TV show that I saw, ironically enough.
What TV show?
It was a TV show in Michigan that aired on public access in Michigan with the cute name Days of Our Lies. Not to be confused with the soap opera Days of Our Lives, but Days of Our Lies. I happened to watch the first episode of this show that aired a week after I graduated from high school. This was 1992.
Where'd you grow up?
Michigan, okay. In Grand Rapids.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and Grand Rapids has a reputation. In fact, I actually just got an email this afternoon from a friend of mine who says, I like Grand Rapids. It's just too Republican for my tastes.
It's true.
And,
I mean,
well, the thing is, though, that I was kind of apolitical growing up. Most people tend to be. The thing that made me political happened to be the TV show I watched. It was a critical news program that on its first episode had as its first segment a story about the media. And it mentioned two things. One was it was making a bold prediction that media was concentrating and increasing in concentration, going from about 50 companies who were commanding the lion's share of what Americans see, hear, and read mm-hmm. in the United States about 1980 or so. And he made the prediction that in a number of years it would be down to as few as 6. It was wrong. It wound up getting down to as little as 5.
Okay.
So it wound up actually being too conservative in its estimates. Not only to talk about that, but it also talked about the fact about how this affect what people hear on the news or don't hear on the news, or how it's portrayed, or how aspects of it are ignored. And they mentioned a number of examples that they had cited. And this was a humongous revelation for me. I felt like not only had my eyes opened up widely, but that I felt robbed. I mean, it's like I thought of myself as a pretty well-informed, educated individual who was pretty, not to say I knew everything, but at least I would have heard something on something that, wow, this sounds pretty big and pretty important. How come I never heard about this before in my life?
Yeah.
And so that was one thing. It kind of bubbled under the surface and I would get a little bit of involvement, but what really crystallized my involvement was a conference that I was a part of that took place in November 2002 on the campus of Loyola University here in Chicago.
And this was way after you had been in high school.
Yeah, no. By this time, I was actually going after my second master's degree.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. On a Saturday afternoon, I was a part of a group at the time called Chicago Media Watch. A group that had been around for about 10 years. I was doing work on media. They published a regular newsletter. I helped them set up a website. And that was how I got involved with them, because I work as a software developer and web developer for a long time, still do, in fact. And the second thing is, they also hold conferences like once every 1 or 2 years. And so they held a conference, and I was a part of it, and I was floored about what happened at that conference. A conference that was ostensibly about progressive perspectives regarding media had the president of the organization that threw the conference made a last-second unannounced schedule change where someone decidedly unprogressive was added to the agenda. To fill in some of the gaps here, the gentleman who spoke at the conference, a gentleman named Sut Jolly, who's on the faculty at the University of Massachusetts in their communications department, he was invited by Chicago Media Watch to speak at this conference.
Okay.
And he did, and he gave a speech about Palestine. He actually helped to produce a film that was just about to be released.
Okay.
And so he said, I'm going to talk about this. Now, this kind of butted heads with both the president of Chicago Media Watch and a number of their key organizers and funders who didn't want to have Palestine talked about. And do you want me to elaborate on that?
I'm assuming because they're Jewish.
Well, you find plenty of progressive Jews about this, but they were not progressive Jews.
Okay.
Even though politically they were progressive on practically every other issue, they weren't on Israel-Palestine.
Okay.
But they were in a pickle in that they already invited Sut Jolly.
Of course.
He was a humongously popular speaker. He spoke at previous conferences.
They had to know that he was going to speak about this.
They didn't. They didn't. At least as far as I could tell.
It's not like you could just make a film in a day. I mean, obviously the film was about
to come out. But the thing is that, that's an interesting circumstance here. They apparently are pleading ignorant or didn't know or something. The fact of the matter is that they didn't want him to talk about this, except that they couldn't disinvite him.
Okay.
And they couldn't ask him to change his topic.
Okay.
Because he just simply refused. He said, this is an issue that is just too important and too not talked about, especially as his involvement with media, which is actually what the film was about. It's a film called Peace Propaganda and the Promised Land.
Okay.
And people can look that up and actually watch excerpts of it online. And the problem here was that they didn't want to have this screen this speech made, but they couldn't do it. So he gave the speech. So the compromise that was offered was that the regional education director, so-called, of the American Israel Political Action Committee, APAC, probably as right-wing a group as they come regarding matters regarding the Middle East, was invited as a, quote, balance, unquote.
And how did that turn out?
Not very well. To put it mildly, upon its announcement, we had one person, a friend of mine, Chris Giovannis, who's been involved in Chicago indie media, who upon the announcement, charged the stage, screaming the whole time, stood in protest. An ultimatum was declared by the president of Chicago Media Watch saying, people who don't want to hear this should just up and leave. And about a dozen people did, and I actually count myself among those.
Okay.
It was outside that meeting when this happened, when a lot of people were just up in arms about what was happening, that Chris herself laid the gauntlet down and said, we are creating a new group. And or ask people to come to a meeting that she was going to organize the following week.
And this is the person that originally booked the guy.
No. This is someone else who was actually booked as another as a future panel at the same conference.
Okay.
Who basically said we're going to form a new group because if this is what we've got to work with in terms of what's supposedly progressive media activism in Chicago, this isn't a whole hill of beans. And so what then wound up happening is that Chris Giovannis wound up leaving the conference, getting expelled from the conference, wound up ordered by Loyola police to leave campus, and when she didn't do that as promptly as they thought, she was placed under arrest.
And what happened to her after that?
Well, she was released thereafter. There was a humongous firestorm of criticism, especially in the progressive political community about this. Michael Miner wrote an article in the Chicago Reader about this, a fairly lengthy one, which you can still look up. It's still there. Look for an article with the headline, Man Bites Watchdogs. and it tells the entire story. It actually quotes me in a couple of instances.
Nice.
And that meeting happened. That meeting, launched what became was given a project that's launched a project that was given the name the Chicago Progressive Media Working Group, which 2 months later then changed again to the name Chicago Media Action.
Okay.
A group which I'm a part of still, and which is still doing work and kicking around and has been involved ever since then on media issues, large and small, locally, regionally, and nationally, including that of the DTV matter.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you feel the same passion you had since that initial day when you watched Days of Our Lives, and
yeah,
like that's, you still feel that way.
Oh yeah.
Nothing has subsided in you.
No. If anything, it's grown. It's because I know a lot more about how shady and corrupt and sordid this whole situation has been. And my, I feel it my duty as the people who made Days of Our Lives produce, kind of pass the torch to me. I owe it to myself to pass the torch on to others in any and every way I can, as much as I can.
Do you feel like this will ever end?
Good question. I assume, I kind of work under the assumption that it won't. And I think,
I think you're safe on that.
I think for good reason, because if if it turns out that it does, I think I can find plenty of things to do with my spare time.
Well, yeah, you do have other hobbies.
Yeah, no,
and I'm not saying this is a hobby.
No. Well, I mean, in some respects, it is a hobby. I'm not doing this for money.
This. Yeah.
Nothing. In fact, money that I have received when people have paid me for, like I get honoraria to speak from time to time. Money I get from that, I donate to organizations I'm part of. That actually also amounts to some game show wins that I've had in recent years. And this could be a segue to talk about.
Well, no. Do you want to talk about this?
Sure.
Or do you want to keep talking about the other stuff?
Your call.
We'll do the game show thing. I got to have you back, though, because this thing could go for hours.
Yeah, totally. But,
like, this
I'd
is
love
just,
to be back.
This is the summary of Mitchell.
Mitchell, like, how long have we been at this now?
We've already been at 31 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I've asked, like, three questions here. You're great. Mitchell, how do I put this correctly, is into game shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's part, I'm going to say this, I don't know if I'm right.
Yeah.
Him and a few other people were the people that make up, like, the Scholastic Bowls. They're the people that do the questions. Is that correct?
The company is called National Academic Quiz Tournament.
And then you're part of that.
I've been a part of it. I was actually in the hotel room in the Philadelphia Sheraton where the organization that became NAQT started.
Okay. So
I was there,
on the
present at the creation.
Floor.
Yeah.
You were also on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
That's right.
You were also writing a book about this.
Yes. It's might be the kind of thing I may finish up after I finish my game show career.
Okay.
I'm hoping to try out for Jeopardy in the fall.
So let's start out how you're interested. How did you get interested in game shows?
Oh, I think I've been interested in game shows since the earliest memory of television I have was watching a game show.
Did you watch a lot of TV as a child? Or was it like
a... That's a good question.
Did you stumble upon this thing?
Watching TV, especially in the mornings, and especially when I was growing up, there were a lot of game shows around.
Okay.
And it was just like a duck to water. It just appealed to me almost right away.
Why is that?
I've always been into games that challenge the mind. And things like... games like Scrabble or Trivial Pursuit or TV shows like Jeopardy or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Things like this just naturally appeal to me. They always have.
What did you go to college for?
I went to the University of Michigan. I got an undergraduate degree in anthropology and linguistics, and then two graduate degrees, both from the University of Chicago, a linguistics degree in 1998 and a computer science degree in 2003.
Why even get the computer science degree? Is that only to pay the bills, or are you actually as passionate about that as you are as the game shows and the political action?
A little bit of both. I have far greater odds to get a well-paying job in computers than I do in linguistics.
Of course.
And but also I like computers. I've had an aptitude for mechanical things, and I've been lucky enough to have had work as a software developer for close to a decade now.
Let's say it's 30 years ago. What would you have done?
Probably some kind of engineering of some kind, I suppose.
Okay.
Yeah.
So something that's in the
something cinema. Mechanical, or also I could see myself doing some kind of like translation work, like working as a translator across languages.
How many languages do you speak?
I English, Polish to a great extent. I'm got some conversational competence in American Sign Language. And also varying degrees of study in, let's see, Spanish, German, Latin, probably a couple of others. I'm not
all right. When you say various
Russian.
Degrees of study, do you mean like if you happen upon two people speaking German, you can understand it, like most of it, kind of thing, or
Probably not anymore.
Or you can ask, like, hey, where's the exit? Like,
probably basic stuff like okay. that. I mean, in Polish, I'm far more adept in that. In American Sign Language, I can probably... I've had conversations with native ASL speakers.
How did you get into that?
That's another interesting story. That was actually my cousin. my cousin's first Holy Communion party when I was 7 years old. Someone there brought a book. I later found out it was a book called The Joy of Signing, which was a book that was about American Sign Language and various signs that you can use not only with your hands, your arms, your face, and your entire body for expressing language. And I thought this was the coolest thing. And it was shortly thereafter that I kind of like studied a little bit about it. I read a couple of books, and it kind of dropped off. But I kind of made the vow to myself, someday, somewhere, I'm going to learn this. Fast forward to the mid-90s, I'm at the University of Chicago. I'm pursuing a graduate degree in linguistics. It turns out two things come into play that actually make this a possibility for me. One, the University of Chicago is one of the few institutions probably in the country that actually has accredited courses in American Sign Language. A lot of places don't offer courses, or if they do, they tend to be kind of like non-credit electives. The University of Chicago, it was a full accredited course, and the second thing is that it filled a requirement I needed.
Okay.
A non-Indo-European language requirement. It had to be a language that was not part of the family of Indo-European languages that comprise those of most of Asia and Europe.
So you could have taken like Swahili or something.
I could have taken like, you know, any, a lot of African and Bantu languages, Chinese, Japanese, a lot of Oriental languages, a lot of Austronesian languages, okay. a lot of indigenous languages to this hemisphere. So I could have taken Cherokee. Or Navajo and indigenous languages of North America or Mexico or any
when
place.
You went to go get the degree in linguistics, mm-hmm. what did you think you would do with it?
The original hope was actually to become a historian of words, an etymologist is the technical term. Over the course of studying the degree, that was the original plan. Over the course of the degree, it was kind of realized probably go into phonology, the study of sound patterns in language. But it didn't really materialize.
Okay, back to the game shows.
Sure,
really
back quick. To game shows.
you are involved. You said that you were trying to get on Jeopardy. Since I've known you, you've been trying to get on Jeopardy.
Yeah.
Is Jeopardy the Holy Grail?
For me, it is.
Why is that? Just because the one you grew up with?
I've watched it ever since it started airing 25 years ago. It's up my alley in so many ways in that it's not only a quick recall game, which is my specialty. I played games like this since forever, but with a special ferocity in college and in graduate school when I had the good fortune to be part of teams that did this. So that's another reason. And also the fact that it's still something I've got eligibility for. I can still be on it. And now...
What do you mean eligibility? Explain this to people.
Well, I can still appear as a contestant on the show and be on TV and win real money. Sometimes, and a lot of money. And that's what I was about to get to, is that there is... If you play your cards right and if things go your way, there is a lot of money to be made.
Of course.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how are you still... You say eligible. How are you not eligible? How would you not be able to...
Jeopardy has a number of requirements in that, for one, you can't have previously appeared on Jeopardy.
Okay.
And so that if you're already a contestant, you can't go back unless they invite you back. You basically have a one-shot, one-and-done deal, as it's mm-hmm. called. The second thing is that Jeopardy itself has requirements about appearances on other game shows or reality shows. You can't have appeared on a game show or reality show at any point within the last 12 months and no more than 3 in the last 10 years.
Okay, so and you've appeared on one, right?
I've appeared on two, actually.
What was the other one?
Trivial Pursuit America Plays.
I forgot that the show existed.
Yeah, most people did. Yeah. I happened to be a part of a screening where they aired questions of mine, and it aired, and I didn't win anything.
Damn.
But and worse, I called the Jeopardy staff and I explained, look, I made a disappearance. It wasn't in studio. I could have won money. Does this affect my eligibility? And their verdict was yes. So this counts as one of those three appearances. So I if I go on any game show or reality show at any point between starting September, that burns my eligibility for being on Jeopardy for the next 10 years.
No, doesn't it from that point or from the first reality?
No, from that point.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
So this fall, you're trying to get on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I become eligible in September because it's been a year since that my appearance first aired.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's what I hope to do. I don't know. I mean, maybe I can somehow swing it to go to Culver City, California for a tryout. Then that's doable. You can go. If you're in Southern California, you can go and call Jeopardy and actually ask for an appointment. They have rolling tryouts roughly about twice or three times a month. But they also do roving tryouts across the United States. And they come to Chicago like maybe once every 18 months or so. The last two tryouts I've had for Jeopardy have been in Chicago.
And?
And, well, no,
you didn't get it, but
I passed the test. I had what I thought were good interviews. I just never got the callback. And that's nothing you can predict. You can, all you got to do is just hope and pray. And that's, you know, hope and pray again this fall that after I pass the test, which I feel very confident I will do, that I'll, but I mean, not to be dissuaded. I mean, I've known people who've gotten on the show who've tried out 5, 6, 7 times, passed the test, never got the callback, but then finally did. And did very well. I can mention one example. Jerome Verrett. He's actually a writer in Southern California who he told me he tried out 5 times for Jeopardy. Finally, passed every time, finally got the callback. And when he got on, he kicked ass. He won. He became the second highest money winner up to the time of his broadcast. Came in second in the Tournament of Champions. Got invited back to the Ultimate Tournament of Champions that they held in 2004 and finished third in that. Out of 140 past game show champions, this guy finished third.
Smart.
Very smart.
How much did he make total?
Oh, goodness.
A million?
A half million on his... Good question. Probably, I guess, maybe in the ballpark of about $800,000 all told.
And yeah. This was after they allowed you to roll, to keep playing after
this was before that.
Wow.
Yeah, no, this was when they had the limit of 5 times. Yeah, no, that's the thing here. He's been invited back twice for subsequent tournaments, and he's done very well at those. This was still, remember, when he aired, the limit that they had on the number of times a contestant can win was only lifted in 2003.
Yeah, that's when...
Ken Jennings in 2004 shattered every record in game shows worldwide. He actually tied the record for the most consecutive game show appearances by anyone in the world. He tied a gentleman who appeared on a game show 74 times in Japan. And he tied that. So he basically demolished all past records. Yeah. A point of disclosure, I've actually known Ken Jennings through NAQT. He and I actually corresponded through going back to 2001. It was one key question that was named the question of the year in NAQT.
Do you remember it?
It was a question about the... give these following characters from the book Moby Dick based on personal ads they would have written. It was really clever, and it was really funny, and everyone was just dazzled by it. And it was justifiably. And that was where I first encountered him. I was like, this is a new guy.
Well, I'm going to ask you just a few more questions here. Short or long, it's completely up to you.
Yeah.
Do you ever go to bar trivia nights and just kill people?
Oh, yeah. Just to mention one small example recently. My fiance and I have a friend who was living in Chicago, but is going to be moving back to Michigan, where he's originally from, to go to grad school. And so as a kind of bon voyage, we decided to go to pub trivia. And we came in first place. And we went to the spread, and we won $9.20.
Oh,
okay. The top prize was 20% off your bar tab, which for us happened to be $9.20.
That's pretty funny.
So other teams that were there don't feel jealous about winning.
What's your weakness?
For me, watch my millionaire appearance. And you'll
I know your weakness.
Yeah,
I just
everyone
wanted...
knows my weaknesses. Yeah. It's basically three of them: popular music, popular culture after like 1992, and what I stereotypically call women's stuff. So this will mean things like fashion, cooking, interior design, like stuff you watch on Food Network or the Styled Network.
As time goes on, are these questions getting more and more into Jeopardy? Because it seems like every single show...
They've been a part of Jeopardy since forever. I mean...
It doesn't... Maybe those are the questions I'm finally, like, getting as the older I get. We're like, I'll nail those. But
Right.
Okay. In an ideal world, you wake up tomorrow, what's your situation?
As far as...
Everything. I mean, everything. Okay. Like, the political stuff, the digital... stuff, the game show stuff... The work, everything.
Yeah. Game show stuff is, well, for one thing, I get on Jeopardy, but I also, I mean, But that wouldn't happen until the fall.
Okay.
So,
you wake up.
I wake up 3 months later. I try out, and then they like my appearance, and they call me back, and I make my appearance, and I do really, 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 really well. That's ideal thing one. Ideal thing two is the political involvement widens dramatically. And I think it would need to, and I think there's the potential for that, especially now where we're seeing a lot of circumstances in this critical juncture where people have got to start thinking as crazily as possible, precisely because crazy ideas are not bound to reality anymore. I mean, what was thought of as crazy a year ago is now deemed realistic now. And so people have got to come up with ideas like that. Along these lines, I'm actually thinking of there's another group I'm a part of, which could also be a topic of another podcast, a group called CAPES, the Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society. One thing I've also been involved with and kind of stems from the political activism on media is the political economy of our situation generally. And it kind of makes sense. A lot of the fight regarding media has been a fight with the political economy and situation in the United States and worldwide, but focusing on how it applies to the media. So remove that one level above, and so what would be a better better economy? How would that work? How can that be done so that we have more sane and humane outcomes rather than lousy outcomes, especially these days? And how would that work? And so that's what CAPES, this group I helped found, which has been around for 5 years, has been working on. And so that what I would hope to do, and I'm actually working with a couple friends on this, I'm hoping to create a kind of role-playing game based on the model of participatory economics, which is the particular economic model that the group CAPES focuses on. And if I could work on that, and not only that, but I could envision that being the kind of thing where we create it and it's very playable and we put it on Facebook and it takes off like mad. And it's not outside the realm of possibility. We saw two Indian brothers who created a game of a clone of Scrabble. And it became Scrabulous.
Yes,
and it became immensely popular. The most popular app on Facebook, in fact.
Once we're done with this, I got to tell you about this guy that designed
it.
Got to think for
sure,
you.
Sure.
All right, we're going to close this thing.
Okay.
I do have to close
it. But I mean, that would be another thing. It's like have this, you know, we create this game and it takes off like mad. And people can point to this game as something that they can use to envision their the future of our economy in a better way.
You never sleep, do you?
Oh, no. All right. What's that?
Okay, pick a number between 1 and 260. I'm going to ask you a question from the kids' book of questions.
My favorite number is 92, so I'll say 92.
Why is 92 your favorite number?
The year 1992 holds a particular significance for me in a lot of ways.
Okay, 92. There you go. Do you pick your nose or bite your nails? If so, do you think you always will, or will you stop one day?
Okay, this is going to be the most embarrassing thing I have ever said in any medium in my entire life. I don't chew my nails. I do pick my nose.
There you go. But do you do it in public?
Not anymore.
There you go. Then you're fine. I think you're totally fine.
Okay.
Mitchell, you're one of the smartest people I've... Say your last name again. Mitchell.
Szczepańczyk.
That's
if you
it.
Go to my website at szcz.org, there's a page on the pronunciation, including an MP3 of me pronouncing my name twice for those who want to practice.
I just didn't want to do what Mare of the Fiera did. I remember watching you on there.
Meredith Vieira has an exchange with me about my last name.
You don't seem to be happy about that.
It was. I was just like, okay, here we go now. just please, God, let it be quick.
We're gonna close this thing. I gotta plug some stuff. Do you need to plug anything really quick?
My website, Chicago Media, szcz.org, ChicagoMediaAction.org, ChicagoParicon.org, Chicago.IndieMedia.org. And WHPK.org, which is the website where I host a radio show of my own.
That's the U of C radio station.
Yep, the University of Chicago's radio show. I have a show on Thursday afternoons called The Ministry of Truth. I'm all about politics and other cool stuff.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you
for doing this.
No problem.
I'm going to plug some stuff here. At The Brain, this next upcoming Monday, we're going to be screening a documentary. It's called Out of Tune. It's a documentary about live music that Jesse made. Jesse's from the band Beard. You can go hear a Beard song at the other podcast, the You, Me, Them, Everybody Chicago Music Podcast. Once again, thanks to Mitchell, and have a wonderful evening. I'm going to close this one with Outer Petter. Outer Petter are playing July 31st at the Bee Kitchen, the Friends of the Show, blah, blah, blah. Once again, have a wonderful night. I stand
Yeah.